I'm going to read from my most recent novel, The Friend. Well, as some of you know, the narrator of The Friend is a writer and a teacher of writing, and she has just lost her lifelong friend and mentor to suicide and become the caretaker of his 180-pound Great Dane named Apollo. And Apollo was a dog that was a stray, that was found abandoned in a park. So nobody knows what his real history is. The you that the narrator addresses in these pages is the mentor, the friend who committed suicide. So there they are, the dog and the narrator squeezed together in her 500 square foot rent-stabilized Manhattan apartment whose lease stipulates that no dogs are allowed. And they are both in a stunned state of grief. Advice often given to writers, read your drafts out loud. Advice I am usually too lazy to follow. But I will try anything these days that might keep me longer at my desk. I pick up the pages I've just printed out and start reading. Behind me, I hear Apollo, who has been sleeping behind the couch, heave himself to his feet. He trots to the desk. We are about eye to eye when I'm sitting, and stares at me as if I'm doing something remarkable. Or maybe, though we've had one long walk already today, he wants to go out again. When I reach the bottom of the page, I pause, thinking. Apollo pokes me with his nose. He barks very low, just once. He takes a step forward, a step to the right, a step back, all the while cocking his head from side to side, his way of saying, "What the fuck?" He wants me to keep reading. True or not, that's what I do. But soon I stop. Read your sentences out loud, goes the advice, and you'll hear what doesn't sound right, what doesn't work. I hear what doesn't sound right, what doesn't work. I hear. No different from when I read the sentences to myself. I fold my arms on the desk and hide my face in them. Poke. Woof. I turn my head. Apollo's gaze is deep. He licks my face and does the cha-cha thing again. He wags his tail, and for the thousandth time, I think how frustrating it must be for a dog, the endless trouble of making yourself understood to a human. I move from chair to couch, Apollo watching, forehead creased. Once I'm settled, he comes and sits down in front of me, eye to eye. What do dogs think when they see someone cry? Bred to be comforters, they comfort us. But how puzzling human unhappiness must be to them. We who can fill our dishes anytime we want and with as much food as we like, who can go outside whenever we wish and run free. We who have no master, constantly needing to be pleased or obeyed. What the fuck? From the stack of books on the coffee table, I pick up Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, an assigned book for one of the courses I'm teaching. I open it and start reading out loud. After a few pages, Apollo assumes the half-open-mouthed smile seen all the time on other dogs' faces, but with worrying infrequency on his. As I keep reading, he lowers himself to the floor, covering my feet and pressing against my shins. He relaxes his head onto his paws, tipping his eyes at me each time I turn a page. The position of his ears shifts in response to my vocal inflections. I read on as clearly and with as much expression as I would to someone who could understand every word. And I too find it soothing, the lyrical prose in my mouth, the great warm, gently heaving weight on my legs and feet. I know this little book well, 10 letters addressed to a student who'd written to ask Rilke for advice when Rilke himself was just 27 years old. Letter 8 contains his famous vision of the Beauty and the Beast myth. Perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us act just once with beauty and courage. Perhaps everything that frightens us is, in its deepest essence, something helpless that wants our love. Beware irony, ignore criticism, look to what is simple, study the small and humble things of the world, do what is difficult precisely because it is difficult, do not search for answers, but rather love the questions, do not run away from sadness or depression, for these might be the very conditions necessary to your work. Seek solitude, above all, seek solitude. I have read Rilke's advice so often, I know it by heart. When I read the letters for the first time, at around the same age as Rilke when he wrote them, I felt that they had been written as much to me as to their addressee, that all this wonderful advice was meant for any person who wished to become a writer. But now, though the writing might strike me as more beautiful than ever, I cannot read it without uneasiness. I cannot forget my own students who do not feel at all what the young poet must have felt when he received them in the first decade of the last century. They do not feel what we felt when you assigned this book to us, 3/4 of a century later, along with Rilke's autobiographical novel, The Notebooks of Malte Lauritz-Brigge. They do not feel that Rilke is speaking to them. On the contrary, they accuse him of excluding them. They say it's a lie that writing is a religion requiring the devotion of a priest. They say it's ridiculous. When I tell them the myth about Rilke's death, how it came to be said that the onset of his fatal disease occurred after he pricked his hand on the thorn of a rose, that flower that obsessed him and was such a significant symbol in his work, they groan, and one student can't stop laughing. There was a time when young writers, at least the ones we knew, believed that Rilke's world was eternal. I agree with my students that that world has vanished, but at their age, it would not have occurred to me that it could vanish, let alone in my lifetime. Nothing brings more anxiety than Rilke's avowal that a person who feels he can live without writing shouldn't be writing at all. Must I write is the question he commands the student to ask himself in the most silent hour of your night. If you were forbidden to write, would you die? Words taken to heart by Lady Gaga, or at least to biceps, which is where she had them in their original German tattoo. Once again, I come upon Rilke's famous definition of love, 2 solitudes that protect and border and greet each other. What does that even mean, writes a student in her final paper? It's just words. It has nothing to do with real life, which is where love actually happens, the exasperated, hostile tone so often to be found in student papers. In real life, he could not be a husband to his wife, whom he left about a year after their marriage. He could not be a father to his daughter. Rilke, who found such richness and meaning in the experience of childhood, and who wrote so many beautiful words about children, neglected his only child, which did not stop her from dedicating her life to his work and his memory. Then, aged 71, she killed herself. Rilke, who loved dogs and looked hard at them and shared a boundless communion with them, who once found in the imploring look of an ugly, heavily pregnant stray that he encountered outside a cafe in Spain, everything that probes beyond the solitary soul and goes God knows where, into the future or into that which passeth understanding. He fed her the lump of sugar from his coffee, which he later wrote was like reading mass together. Rilke, in whose work Apollo, is a recurring figure. The book is short. It can be read aloud in about 2 hours. But soon Apollo has dropped off like a child at whose bedside a mother has been reading and waiting for precisely this moment to tiptoe away. I'm not tiptoeing anywhere. Pinned beneath his weight, my feet have gone numb. I wiggle them and he wakes. Without getting up, he seeks my hand, still holding the little book, and he licks it. Now we are both up heading for the kitchen. I pour him some kibble, it's that time, and while he eats, I get ready to take him out. I might have dismissed the incident as something out of my anthropomorphic fancy, but the very next day, this happens. I'm sitting on the couch with my laptop when Apollo comes up and starts sniffing the books on the coffee table. His giant jaws open and close around the new paperback copy of the Knausgård novel that I bought to replace the one he destroyed. Oh, not again. But before I can take it away, he gently places the book by my side. I've heard of therapy dogs, of course, dogs trained to work in hospitals, nursing homes, disaster areas, and the like, their purpose to bring comfort and cheer in hopes of lightening whatever suffering humans might be going through. I know such dogs have been around a long time, also that they are now often used to help children with emotional or learning difficulties. To improve speech and literary skills, children in schools and libraries are being encouraged to read aloud to dogs. Excellent results have been reported, with children who read to dogs said to progress significantly better than children who read to other humans. Many of the listeners are said to appear to enjoy themselves, showing signs of alertness and curiosity. But an analysis of the full benefits to canines of being read to by humans is not something my research turns up. It occurs to me that someone used to read to Apollo. Not that I think he was a trained, certified therapy dog. Would such a valuable animal end up astray? But I believe that someone must have read aloud to him, or if not to him, at least while he was present, and that his memory of that experience is a happy one. Maybe it was just that whoever did the reading was someone he loved. Or maybe, though not a professional therapy dog, Apollo had nevertheless been expected to help someone by listening to that person read, a responsibility he took seriously and for which he was praised and rewarded. It's in the nature of many dogs to do some kind of work, training manuals say. Assigned a task, dogs showing signs of boredom or depression often perk up, but people almost never give them enough, if anything, to do. Or maybe Apollo is a canine genius who has figured something out about me and books. Maybe he understands that when I'm not feeling so great, losing myself in a book is the best thing I could do. Maybe this is something his phenomenal nose tells him. If, as studies show, a dog's nose is capable of detecting cancer, it would not be surprising if it could also detect changes caused by the relief of stress or by the experience of mental stimulation or pleasure. If some dogs can predict seizures in people, as we know has occurred, how strange would it be for one to predict a looming fit of the blues? In fact, the more I live with Apollo, the more convinced I am that the vet was right. We humans don't know the half of how dogs' brains work. They may well, in their mute, unfathomable way, know us better than we know them. In any case, the image is irresistible, an avalanche of despair, and like the Saint Bernard coming through the snow with a mini barrel of brandy, Apollo fetches a book. Even if we know St. Bernard's never really did that. There was a time when it would have been clearer to me whether reading Rilke's letters to a young poet to a dog was a sign of mental unbalance. I decided to make reading aloud part of our routine. Knowing how this might look to others, though, I don't tell anyone. But then there's a lot in these pages I've never told anyone. It is curious how the act of writing leads to confession, not that it doesn't also lead to lying your head off. Like Rilke, Flannery O'Connor wrote a series of letters to a stranger who wrote to her one day out of the blue. In the collection of O'Connor's letters published after her death, this particular correspondent, who'd asked to remain anonymous, is called A. At 32, she is 2 years older than O'Connor, who is nevertheless more than up to shouldering the role of mentor. The letters to A, written over a period of 9 years, are filled with thoughts about literature and religion, and what it means to be a writer and a believer in the Catholic Church. She talks freely about her fiction writing, and when A sends her some of her own fiction, the response is encouraging. A has a gift for story writing, O'Connor says, judging one particular story to be just about perfect. When A appears to be suffering from a block, O'Connor is quick to blame the devil. For the serious Catholic O'Connor, the devil is not a metaphor. Though in time the two women arrange to meet, they will not do so often. Meanwhile, on paper, the friendship thrives, bringing them close enough for O'Connor to call A her adopted kin. Overjoyed when A decides to join the church, she agrees to be her confirmation sponsor. But in the end, the devil won. A loses her faith, she leaves the church. Though she produces work in several genres, she publishes nothing. At 75, 34 years after O'Connor's death from lupus at the age of 39, Hazel Elizabeth Hester, known as Betty, shoots herself to death. If O'Connor had been my mentor, if she'd been writing to me, I might have asked her this. What exactly did Simone Weil mean when she said, "When you have to make a decision in life about what you should do, do what will cost you the most. Do what is difficult because it is difficult. Do what will cost you the most." Who were these people? If writing wasn't painful, O'Connor says, it would not be worth doing. Turn then to Virginia Woolf, who said that putting feelings into words takes the pain away. Making a scene come right, making a character come together, there was no greater pleasure, she said. Watching Apollo sleep, the peaceful rise and fall of his flank, his belly is full, he is warm and dry. He has had a 4-mile walk today. As usual, when he hunched in the street to do his business, I guarded him from passing cars. And in the park, when a texting jogger bore down on us, Apollo barked and blocked his path before he could run into me. I have played several rounds of tug of war with him today. I have talked to him and sung to him and read him some poetry. I have trimmed his nails and brushed every inch of his coat. Now, watching him sleep, I feel a surge of contentment. There follows another, deeper feeling, singular and mysterious, yet at the same time perfectly familiar. I don't know why it takes a full minute for me to name it. What are we, Apollo and I, if not two solitudes that protect and border and greet each other? Thank you.